utility poles, the wooden telephone poles, every 150 feet or so, down almost all of our residential streets. How do we tolerate that as opposed to insisting on underground wiring? And we've had it there all of our lives. We don't even see it anymore. But you make a change, put in a telephone pole that's a little bit taller or a new cell site, and everybody's up in arms. So we resist change. It's a funny characteristic of human beings and human nature, I guess we're talking about here. Can you imagine if there really were tens of thousands, hundreds or millions of Americans or people in general being damaged by cell sites? Would we be allowed to continue using cell phones under those conditions? Not a chance in the world. So we've now been using cell phones for, what, 30 years or so, 20 years at least, and there is no documented evidence that people using a cell phone have suffered biological damage. Could you choose a person that is super sensitive and he's right at the threshold of getting some kind of a biological effect, and now the cell site, the cell phone he uses is just enough to kick him over the edge? Yes, I think it's possible, but to document that would be
Repeater, timeout.
To really document that in a way traceable to the Bureau of Standards would be extremely difficult. So, for lots of decades now, by way of the American National Standards Institute, C95 report, and all of those best laboratories and institutions have been doing all of these zillions of tests, and they can't find any non-thermal effect. In other words, you get a little bit of heating when you're near a strong RF transmitter of some kind. The RF energy absorbed creates some heating. And when the heating is at the level where it could give you some grief, you would be feeling that heat immediately. I mean, it's the equivalent of a blind man laying on the beach, and you've got an umbrella over him, and he doesn't know it, but you've removed the umbrella, and the sun is now shining on him. He would know that immediately. And that's an amount of RF energy that's way below the threshold of what we're talking about here, where, I mean, that's not RF energy, but you know what I mean. It's electromagnetic energy coming from the sun.
Comet.
So, look, it sounds like Comet wants to make a comment. Go right ahead, sir. N2FDJ. I can't find my call letters on you right now. K2IZF, you know who you are.
2XGN.
N2XGN, go right ahead.
Yeah, but at quite the time I was interested with what is really the impact of electromagnetic waves on the human body. And quite easy. There are only a few factors. One is related to the energy level, which is in electron volts or kilo electron volts or mega electron volts. The other one is related to inverse square law. And in between that, we could have radio, microwave, infrared, visible, ultraviolet, X-ray, and gamma. And now we're thinking, okay, is solar power dangerous? Is HF dangerous? Let me drop. So we can say that the ultraviolet is considered to be partially dangerous because it's from 3 to 30 electron volts, which is the energetic level of that radiation. And then soft X-ray will start from 100 to 1,000 electron volts. But then we have that factor of inverse square law, which actually stands about this specified physical quantity or intensity that is inversely proportional to the square of the distance. So we may say that if you have 1,000 watt and then you have a frequency of 400 megahertz, then you take the energetic level of that frequency and multiply by 1,000 and then see how close it would affect that. That was, let me wrap up.
WS2N.
So that was the problem of many of us thinking, okay, well, cellular tower will be dangerous. You have a 10 watts of cellular tower and you are at the distance of 200 feet, then the impact is minimal. But what is interesting, infrared. Infrared stretches and bends the molecules and the single atoms. So we may say, is infrared dangerous? And I would love to have your comment on it. And
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I'm sorry about that. My question was, is the infrared dangerous because it stretches and bends molecules or single atoms? And to you.
WS21.
Before we enter that infrared question, go ahead, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, I thought Wesley was finished. Now, well, this is regarding cell phone towers, but I don't know if you're aware that this Thursday, the White House plans on transmitting on all cell phone towers at the exact same time to test an emergency alert system. Have you heard this thing? I'm just wondering, you know, could you imagine somebody's going to write a report saying because all the towers went off at the exact same time, all that wattage is going to add up. I can just see it. But I don't know if you're familiar with what's going to happen on Thursday.
Yeah, it's a test of the emergency communication system, I think it's called. We'll eventually turn it over to Eric for better words on that. And so if you want to alert the whole population simultaneously, they want to make sure they have the ability to do that, is what I think is going on. As you go to higher and higher frequencies, the amount of energy per wave, so to speak, increases. And so when you get above optical frequencies, ultraviolet, near X-ray, now you're getting enough energy where you are becoming ionizing. In other words, the wave is capable of disturbing DNA and potentially creating a cancer or some other kind of grief. When you're below optical frequencies, near infrared, far infrared, upper microwave, when you're down to the RF frequencies and below infrared, infrared and below, the amount of energy is not enough to do ionizing. It is only a wave that creates heating. Maybe somebody believes that infrared creates a bending of the wave. That doesn't mean that it suddenly becomes ionizing. It's still a non-ionizing, only a wave that creates heating. So all the evidence to date says that cell phones are extremely safe and cell sites are a million times safer than the cell phone itself. Because you compare this million-to-one ratio you get because of 200 feet of distance to the cell site versus a half inch of distance between the antenna and your head when you're holding a cell phone against your head. If you want to be super conservative, let me drop. If you want to be super conservative, you could decide you're going to hold the cell phone a little further distance away from your head and using it in the, what are they called now, the speaker mode, or using it with a headset if you want to be safer. But there is no evidence that cell phones create all of this damage. The fact that you can find a website saying it doesn't mean it's true. There are some very sincere people. Milton Zarrett, I think is the man's name, who wrote the book called The Zapping of America. He was led to believe, he's an optical physician, an ophthalmologist, who has, in a sincere effort, and I've had some conversations with him, and I got a copy of his book, he really believes that the people who he has done eye examinations on that work near radio equipment, he thinks he can see damage in the eyes of these people. It hasn't been very well documented, and there's an awful lot of people who have got some pretty strong skepticism about this. He was written up in Scientific American magazine. One of his books is called The Zapping of America, and the other book he's written is called The Waves of Death, or something like that is the name of it. In other words, he believes that the magnetic field radiated by the power lines are creating grief in human beings. He believes that. As I said, he's a sincere guy. The fact that he's written a book on it, let me drop it. Yeah, Currents of Death is the name of his second book. Currents of Death, he believes 60 cycle power lines are creating grief to human beings. The fact that he's written a book, the fact that he's got it published, even though the book is written up in places like Scientific American, Science Magazine, where they say that it is not well documented and there's no evidence that what it says is accurate, the fact that you can find it on a website and in a book doesn't mean that it's the truth, that it's real. So you got to be careful when you hear exciting pieces of information like this. When it comes to news, you've heard the expression, if it bleeds, it leads. I mean, news that reports really bad situations is a lot more exciting to listen to than news that says everything's hunky-dory. You wouldn't bother listening to news saying everything's hunky-dory in this town. We have no problems in this town. You could have a news report on that, and nobody would listen to it. Nobody would watch it, if you know what I mean. Anybody with any further questions or comments on this subject, give me a call at us now, K2LIW in the TechNet.
You're just talking about infrared, Drexia.
The fact that somebody says an infrared wave gets bent doesn't show any... I'm not getting any favorable effect out of that. Eric, you said you wanted to say something. N2EJ, K2LIW.
Yeah, Dick. Actually, the test that Paul is talking about is actually something called IPOIS, which is the Integrated Public Alert and Warning System, which comes out of FEMA. But it actually includes, this is actually the fourth in a series of tests. We've actually had to change software because the last three tests have had problems. But on the 20th of September, it'll first start off with a WEA, which is Wireless Emergency Alert. That portion will be transmitted at 2:18 p.m. and will continue to be transmitted from cell towers for 30 minutes. And at 2 minutes later, at 2:20, will be the EAS, or the Emergency Alert System, portion, which will be on every radio and TV station. And it's going to actually read that this is a presidential message, and it will say this is a test of the National Wireless Emergency Alert System. No action is needed for what's going to show up on your cell phone. And, of course, it will be a similar message from the broadcasters. K2RW, K2J.
Now, here's the bottom line question, Eric. Is anybody that you know of concerned, are you concerned, that the simultaneous turn on in various tests of all this equipment, whether or not psychologically we know there's going to be reports, but will it really create any damage, any deleterious effects to human beings? I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this one. K2EJ, K2RAW.
Well, let's put it this way. You know, as far as damage to human beings, it's going to be psychological. If they don't read it, it says this is a test, and, you know, you want to go back to Orson Welles' War of the Worlds and be my guest. But as far as the RF part of it goes, well, it's no different than using your cell phone.
NY2H.
Go right ahead, Lou. Wait for the beeps.
Alrighty, so we're bouncing around on these topics, and the common theme seems to be the possibility of a psychotic or, you know, delusional interpretation. So just to go back, and this will be a footnote, and then we can drop it, but to go back to that Cuba thing, I did send to you and Roy the Journal of the American Medical Association concerning how the University of Pennsylvania took these people, about 21 people, and did studies on them. And from that report, from what I read, it says, and I'll read it to you, the presence of subjective neurological symptoms presenting in a cohesive community has raised concerns for collective delusional disorders, including mass psychogenic illness. Let me let it drop. However, neurological examination and cognitive screens did not reveal evidence of malingering, and objective testing and behavioral observations during cognitive testing indicated high levels of effort and motivation. Several of the objective manifestations consistently found in this cohort, such as oculomotor and vestibular testing abnormalities, could not have been consciously or unconsciously manipulated.
That's pretty deep technical talk. Now, Lou, give us your interpretation of those last couple of sentences. What do you believe those last couple of sentences are saying, Lou? Go ahead.
I believe that, as Roy had said, something did occur, and what it was, we don't know. But it did leave traces, as they say, objective manifestations, which they saw. But again, you have the article, or at least I think I sent you the link to it, and Roy has the article. So, you know, unless John has got an axe to grind, you know, I don't know what to believe anymore. So, you know, but I think they're still pretty reputable. So something did occur. I don't think it's mass psychosis. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, step by step. Roy and I and others are skeptical as to whether or not high-power RF microwave could have done it. Could acoustic energy have done it? That's a little bit more likely, ultrasonic acoustic energy. Let's see, what kind of energy can you aim at human beings? Radio, light, X-ray, acoustic, all kinds. And there's lots and lots of octaves of higher and lower frequencies and all of these that can be done. To do it with radio, you would feel it as heat on your skin when the level is high enough to create effects like we're talking about. Acoustically, and I think some of those reports did display hearing damage. In other words, the person's hearing after the exposure wasn't the same as what they believed the hearing was before. Though all of us are slowly losing some of our high-frequency hearing as we age, so you got to be careful in how you judge that. And the recordings they made... no one explained where that recording came from. Let me drop it. The equivalent of a tape recorder playback was the sound being picked up by a microphone, and that's what we're hearing the playback as? Or was the electromagnetic energy so strong that it was being picked up by the directly by the electronics of the tape recorder, so to speak? That wasn't explained. The fact that you... And they did display it on the equivalent of a spectrum analyzer. So you did see what looked like an ultrasonic sound being picked up. So apparently that recording was sound being picked up through air. But was the sound loud enough to do hearing damage and other kinds of biological effects to the human beings? If the sound was that loud, possibly you'd be damaging the microphone of that tape recorder. So there's a lot of things that don't quite correlate here. I'm going to turn it over to you, Lou, for any further comments, and I'm going to turn it over to Eric to see what he feels about all of the above. Then I'm going to turn it over to Roy. NY2H, thank you for bringing this to our attention. And yes, I did get your other article. Over to you, Lou, K2LIW.
All righty, very good, NY2H. So... you know, I'll look further into that particular aspect of it, what those reports were about that actually, I think they even played audio, what have you, so I don't know. It's a big mystery. We don't know what, but something seemed to have occurred. The other thing I wanted to do, since Eric's going to pick it up, Eric, on this broadcast coming up on the 20th, I think you said, are we going to get text messages on our phones also as part of that test? That's what I'm wondering also. So over to you, Eric, NY2H.
And before Eric picks that up, Eric, you're a broadcast engineer with lots of decades of experience, and the radio energy coming out of your television and FM broadcast stations that you've worked on over the years is thousands of times greater and the radio energy coming out of a cell site. And so, let me drop.
I have some information, Antoxian.
And people have thought that they're developing deleterious effects by living near a broadcast station. So, over to you for both of those comments, Eric, that there's not much evidence that people living near a broadcast station have suffered energy problems, and you might want to also answer... Lou's question. KE2EJ, K2LIW. Go ahead, Eric. K2LIW.
WK288. Well, interestingly enough, because I was looking at C95.1, and one of the references, there was a study done on amateur radio operators and the incidence of cancer. I haven't read it yet, so I can't give you a response in that, in terms of that. But, let's put it this way. When the World Trade Center went down, and everybody moved over to Alpine, and of course all the bigwig CEOs and really people with lots of money lived in that neighborhood, they actually went to court to try and shut the whole thing down. Of course, that didn't happen, but that's just the fear. Actually, we have next to one of our transmitters, we have this large community development, and they want the tower to go away, but that's not going to happen either, so... as far as what we know in terms of the masses and the commercial interests, as you well know, tobacco should be illegal and not available, but that's not the case. Let me drop. So in terms of Luke's questions, the concept is that every single cell phone in the United States should come up with this presidential message, which will be presidential alert, this is a test message, blah, 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 and the same thing will happen in the broadcast realm. So, yes, you will see a text message on your phone, and it will make a lot of noise, too. And the concept is for every single cell phone that's turned on to be able to pick this up. I was going to say something else, and now I forgot. Oh, well. Yes, I know what it was. That if you look at the way our government is running today, and I'm not going to go there. It's too political. All right, K2RWK to Jack. Stop it.
This call will be happy.
Okay, that was a triple. I heard Lou first. NY2H. Go ahead, Lou, and then I'm going to turn it over to WS2N. Paul, go ahead, Lou.
Now, Eric didn't want to get political, but I just had to say George Orwell would be happy. Dear leader is going to chime all our phones.
Paul, WS2N, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, maybe Eric knows the answer to this. When I read this, I thought to myself, if all the cell phones go off, what about Canada? What about Mexico? For that matter, what about Europe? It's going to go off at... Eastern Standard Time is what they give it to you as. So naturally, California will be 3 hours different, but they'll all be going off at the same time. But will they also go off in Europe? Is there some kind of digital code that only the cell towers in the United States and Hawaii and Puerto Rico? Are they, how are they going to stop it from going off? In Brazil, back you there.
Yeah, Erica, is this only the continental United States? Is there any other country involved? Over to you, Eric. Wait for the beep.
Oh, it's only the continental United States and its territories, which includes Alaska, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, and other U.S. territories. And if you are aware of how the cell sites are put together, actually, Bill, I can't think of his last name, can give you a more exacting thing, but it's part of the U.S. system that was created for WES, so it's not going to happen in Canada, although those people on the border that their cell phones are receiving cell sites in the United States, they'll get it.
Q, Jason.
Go right ahead, Bill, and Bill Fastenow, WB2QGZ. That's the last name he couldn't think of. And what does WES stand for that Eric just mentioned? You've got it, Bill.
Okay, so just my understanding of how it works is these alerts are generated on a cell site-specific basis, so those in coverage of this cell site would receive the message. In other words, it's something that's gross broadcasted out to anybody who is associated with that site. By being in the periphery and that being your server right now, so it wouldn't go off any place else. It's not a phone number or a registration of phone based thing. It's simply based on geographic cell site. That's why you can get a flash flood warning that's confined to just like the south shore of Nassau. It's sort of the same deal. The entity that decides where this is going says, all right, the following area is going to get this flash flood warning, and that encompasses these cell sites. So every user who is registered on those sites will receive that. So that's why it won't go everywhere else on the planet, if that makes sense.
Yes, I think it does. Eric, who ordered this? K2EJ? K2LIW?
The 2TTT comment?
Question, Dick. Who ordered this test, and then we'll pick up TTT after that. Go ahead, Eric.
One more time. I really missed it.
Who ordered this test that's going to take place? Did that come from Mr. Trump?
This has been happening before, Mr. Trump. The IPARS component is run by FEMA, so they're the originator in this particular case. There are other pathways into the system, but the protocol and the way things are all set out, really, it comes out of IPARS, which is really formed by FEMA itself, which is a combination of FEMA, not NSA, the, I can't think of it, it's Homeland Security. Thank you. Oh, there we go.
Okay, thank you. Let's see what Gordon's got to say about this. Hopefully he's high enough up that we can hear him from New Jersey. W2, Tango, 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 K2LIW. Go ahead, Gordon.
I'll be brief. I'm basically saying that these neighborhoods that want top-quality law enforcement need to understand that you, in a modern age, you want these things. These are going to be increasingly LTE, 5G-based services. And if you don't have those services operative in your neighborhood, you will not have the first response coverage that you will expect. You will have third world emergency response in the most affluent neighborhoods. It's absolutely W2TTT.
Yeah, we only heard you 50% of the time, Gordon, so I'm not sure I got a coherent message out of that. Maybe Eric did. K2EJ, did you make more sense out of that, Eric, than I did, K2LIW?
Fortunately, no, Dick. My ears didn't help me. All right, one more time. Is that better?
Okay, give it a try. You're only in there 75% of the time.
Yeah, I'm on the PIP at exit 10, heading south. Okay. What I was saying is that these neighborhoods that want, these affluent neighborhoods that want first world emergency, third world, and they don't understand that increasingly emergency responders and first responders will be dependent on 5G and LTE technologies, and it's amazing that they don't want the coverage that provides those services. It's the public safety needs to make this a public safety issue for neighborhoods and make them understand.
Only 50% copy, Jordan, Gordon. Only 50% copy. And I know you're talking about LTE and the new wider band services. I think you're trying to talk to us something about what the new reliability is going to be, is what I think you're approaching, but I can't tell for sure. Maybe if you keep the message very simple and repeat it, maybe we'll try to figure out what you're trying to say. Over to you, Gordon, K2LIW and the TechNet.
Yeah, no LTE, no 5G, no public safety in a 21st century world. I mean, that's going to be increasingly required in order to deliver emergency to deliver first world services, you need 5G LTE. That's they need to wake up.
Okay, you're saying we have to deliver an emergency service, but we will not have LTE and 5G. That doesn't correlate. So if we don't have those things, and we need reliability, I'm not quite sure what you're saying, Gordon. W2TTT, K2LIW.
If you don't have the advanced
technologies, you won't be able to offer emergency services of first world quality. Okay? For what reason will we not have 5G and LTE, the new services? What's the reason why you think we will not have those? Over to you, Gordon.
Well, let's start with things like FirstNet, things like telemedicine, emergency telemedicine, video capabilities, telemetry, real-time surveillance of bad actors, things like that. You know, they're going to go to Alpine and do bad things, but that's where the money is.
They're going to go to Alpine and do bad things because that's where the money is. I hear the words, but I'm not getting the concept. Eric, you know about Alpine. Can you understand what Eric, what Gordon's trying to say? KE2EJ, K2RIW, and the TechNet?
Not really. Although I could guess at one thing, and that's in terms of traffic within the system. IPOIS is basically what they call CAP, or Common Alerting Protocol, which is a XIMO-based data format for exchanging warnings like Amber Alerts, National Alerts, things of that nature. And that is covered by just about, even if you have an old cell phone that doesn't have LTE in it, you're still going to receive the message. So, and I believe that message is sent over the control channel. So as far as like LTE and 4G being discontinued, the only guess that I would have at that is that not having all the traffic during an emergency alert, but that's just a guess on my part. And emergency telemedicine and things like that.
Okay, so we've got something to look forward to. It's a future test. I think it's time to go over to Roy. He's got a whole nice long list of things that he'd like to discuss tonight. He's going to be doing a little bit of testing with puzzles. The people who listen to the TechNet fall into at least two categories. There are people who just love scientific puzzles, and there are people who strongly hate scientific puzzles. So we're going to try, I think Roy's going to try a few of them to see how it goes, and maybe I'll add one or two of my own, because the smart engineers I worked with would see me coming down the hall at the Airborne Instruments Laboratory and say, hey, Dick, what's the puzzle of the day? Whereas the kind of guys that didn't like puzzles would see me coming down the hall, and they'd turn around and go down another aisle. They didn't want to see me for face-to-face for fear that I would ask them one of these puzzles. And they just couldn't stand to even have the puzzle exposed to them. I had trouble understanding that. AC2GS with the science talk. K2RW. Go ahead, Roy.
Thank you very much, Dick. This is AC2GS. Before I start the science talk, let me run a very short monologue in a subject that's close to my heart, which is a lot of what we kind of skirted around with RF causing cancer and such is an example of something called correlation is not causation. Because two separate things occur at the same point in time doesn't necessarily mean that one causes the other. Studies will prove that most people who pass away sleep on a bed prior to passing away. This doesn't mean that beds cause death. And the problem is, this is leading to all kinds of really bad signs. This is causing people to think that vaccinations give people autism, because the incidence of autism has raised over the last 20 years as the incidence of vaccination. So again, correlation is not causation, and more people are getting measles because their children aren't being vaccinated. So if there's one line for tonight that I'd love you to remember, it's correlation is not causation. Okay, now that I got off my soapbox, I just want to tell everyone once again that if you want to suggest any topics or have any comments or do anything I'm saying, it's mag@ac2gs.com. Also, I maintain a little chat room here for the TechNet, and you can find that by just typing chat.ac2gs.com in your browser. And everything that I talk about will have links to it, And the way to get to the link list is roy.ac2gs.com. Let me drop.
Roy, please lower your audio 1 decibel. I'm listening to you simultaneously on the input and on the output. Absolutely no dropouts on the input. An occasional dropout going through the repeater. And there's a slim chance that the peak of audio is doing it. So lower your audio 1 dB, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
Okay, how's this? I lowered it. Is this okay?
Sounds beautiful to me.
Very good. We'll hope for the best and settle for the rest. So, guys, I thought that we might start with some interactive questions that I would like people to ponder and respond to. Now, the greater the degree of participation, I think the more fun this will hopefully be. Now, last week, Paul mentioned a new movie that will be coming out next month called The First Man, about Neil Armstrong's life leading up to the Apollo 11 mission that landed the first men on the moon. Now, hopefully, I hope that Buzz Aldrin and Mike Collins get some of the movie time. The Apollo 11 mission was a team effort, in my opinion, actually a team of thousands, not only the effort of one heroic man. Now, history seems to indicate that Neil Armstrong was actually quite similar in his personal life to how he was portrayed in NASA press releases. For the most part, these guys came from a culture of experimental test pilots. They were smart, they were brave, but I assume that some of the time, these guys, during their off hours, got into some things that would kick them out of the Boy Scouts. Anyway, Buzz Aldrin is still with us, and some might have seen him as he mugged for cameras during a recent visit to the White House, standing behind the Commander-in-Chief. With all that in mind, does anyone have any guesses first meal consumed on the moon might have been? NASA had an initial cover story, but would anyone like to hazard a guess?
WS2N, of course.
Of course, Paul. Well, I'm sure you read all about it, so you can tell me.
I can go last if you want.
Excellent idea. So is anyone else out there interested in playing a game? What do you think was the very first meal eaten on moon?
It might have consisted of some Tang orange juice, among other things. K2LIW.
That would be a very good guess, and it goes back to another puzzle that I have further down in this subject. But anyone else with any particular opinions of what the very first historic meal might have been for the moon?
Dehydrated ice cream and cake.
Okay, I think those were actually later inventions, and I remember they promoted them heavily on all kinds of news shows to show the kind of semi-yucky nature of them. But that's as good a guess as also. Anyone else with any other guesses of what the first meal on the moon might have been?
I remember. I think it was bacon.
If they had a cup of coffee up there. Cheese.
You mean green cheese from the moon?
Gorgonzola.
Okay. I guess it's time for you, Paul, to set everyone straight.
Yeah, Buzz Aldrin as Neil Armstrong right after they landed. You know, do you mind if I do this? I always wanted to do this. I thought about it before I lunched, but he wanted to take a sip of wine and the Eucharist, because, you know, he was religious, and he wanted to do that. So that was the first meal on the moon.
Right, you, Paul, it was a communion wafer and a communion consecrated wine. I believe that Buzz Aldrin was actually a high up in his local church, and he really wanted to do this. He wanted to do this on the air, I understand, but NASA had already gotten some problems from a previous Apollo mission with a verse from Genesis. and there were some there were some atheists out there that were very annoyed at that, and so they asked Buzz to please do it quietly by himself. So the very first meal on the moon was Union and some wine. That's the answer to that one.
Any idea what that next meal was, Roy?
Yes, actually, if you were to ask NASA at the time what their first meal was, their first scheduled meal were bacon squares, peaches, sugar cookie cubes, pineapple, grapefruit drink, and, as someone mentioned, coffee. That was their scheduled meal, but Buzz had a little communion snack right before that. Okay, on to the next one. The space program drove a lot of innovation, research, and development that lent itself to private sector production. Here is a list of consumer items. Now, what I would like you guys to do is tell me which of these were developed either initially or fully under NASA's guiding eyes and bank book, and which of them were totally independent things that were used but incorrectly thought of as part of NASA's great research and development. So I hope that makes sense to everyone. I'll break and ask if anyone has any problems with that concept. Okay, I'll do them in twos. Tang and Velcro. Does anyone have any opinions if Tang and or Velcro were invented specifically for the space program?
NY2H, no.
Okay, Lou gets a prize. Next two objects were the Fisher Space Pens and Space Blankets. Remember, the Fisher Space Pen was a cartridge with S so that the ink could be written direction. There were stories that the Russians, rather than develop their own, simply decided what the heck was to bring a very inexpensive pencil into space. Space blankets, I'm sure everyone has seen those kind of silvery things. They've even been giving them to the across the border and then locked away in air-conditioned boxes and such. Fisher Space Pens and Space Blankets. What does anyone say?
In one YDY, I say no.
By 2H, I say yes.
RIW, I say yes.
Okay, but they're two separate things. Are you saying yes to both and to no? Are they saying no to both? I'm a little confused.
YDY, I say definitely no to the Fisher Space Pen because I've heard the company spiel on the story and they claim to have done it independently.
Okay, well, yes, the Fisher Space Pen was done completely independently, and NASA just heard about it and just bought a box. I think they tried to cut a discount deal. Space blankets, on the other side, actually come from NASA research and development. So space blankets really depended on NASA.
Could that have been a subset of all of the layers, the multiple layers of a space suit, Roy, go ahead?
Yes, indeed. It was part of their research in thermal control and such that they then spun it out of the company. Working on it into these consumer products, and I assume there's still active patents in one way or another for the product, but I'm sure a lot of people knocked the design completely off.
While we're at it, Paul, you might know, how many layers were there to a space suit? I think there's an awful lot of them. Over to you, Paul, and pass it over to Roy.
Yeah, their suits were like 12 different layers, Dick. It was quite a bit. Going from inside out, tremendous amount of layers. You know, they were all bulked up. You know, they didn't need to be pressurized until it looked like they were bulked up. That's even today, those bases are quite a few layers, probably still 10 layers.
Okay, I have two more items. Next up on the item is Dustbusters. Does anyone think that Dustbusters we had NASA for, or it was a completely independent product?
Just a couple of words as to what a Dustbuster is.
those little vacuums that are rechargeable. You plug it in, you charge it up, you take it out of its little holder, and you clean up the back of the car or something. So it's a hand-sized, chargeable vacuum cleaner.
I'm going to say no, KD2HUC.
Okay, anyone else want to suggest the yay or nay? Okay, in fact, it was a design based on a NASA design for a very efficient motor assembly. They then took that design, miniaturized it, shoved it into a consumer product, and the rest, again, is history. So Dustbusters, we have to thank NASA for as well. Next on my list is those little infrared air temperature detectors that people use for children all the time instead of sticking thermometers in their orifices. Anyone have any opinion whether the infrared air temperature detectors had anything to do with NASA or not?
WB2GXM, yes, NASA was responsible.
Yes, indeed. They were responsible. That is yet another product. So there were many products that NASA actually drove into research and development. Unfortunately, the ones that are usually mentioned, the Tang, the Velcro, and the Fisher space pens, are all incorrectly labeled that. But that doesn't mean that the space program wasn't the impetus for great designs and great products that we use to this very day. So that's my little thing on what NASA produced. Let me drop for a sec.
WS2M for one question.
Yeah, sure, Paul. What's your question?
I have a question that I'm sure maybe somebody would be able to get. The drill on the moon that they used to drill into the soil, that drill, what company developed that? Get an answer for that. Back to you, Roy.
I would totally guess Black & Decker, personally, but I would probably be wrong.
You got it. Very good.
Very good. Lucky guess.
It could have been Rockwell. Black & Decker, beautiful.
Okay, now, there are many ways to demonstrate how minuscule and unaware we are in relation to the enormity of the universe. We've done it before. We'll do it again, no doubt. And just by standing completely still at the equator of the Earth, at sea level, we would be moving at 993 miles per hour due to the spin of the Earth. But due to the Earth's orbit around the sun, we're actually moving at about 666,000 miles per hour. However, our entire solar system orbits the center of the Milky Way at 492,000 miles per hour, which means we're somewhere between 425,000 and 558,000 miles per hour, depending upon which month of the year it is and whether or not the Earth's orbit is going with or against the general direction of the movement of the sun. But let's ignore the sun's movement relative to the galaxy center, because the galaxy itself is hurtling through the universe at a tremendous speed, shuffling all of us along through space at a very serious 1.3 million miles per hour. And you guys all think you're standing still, right?
One correction. I'm sure it's written down there, but you just got one number wrong.
Okay, that's the problem with spell checkers with numbers. Which number did I get wrong?
The speed of the Earth going around the sun. You said 600 and something thousand. It's roughly 60, you know, it's in the 60,000. I always use that as a round number. It's in the 60s, not the 600,000.
Okay, I guess I typed the number 6 too many times. Thank you.
I don't remember the other numbers going around the galaxy. I think it's a quarter of a billion years to make one revolution for the galaxy.
Yeah, it's a big, big galaxy. Anyway, I saw an amusing refutation of a flat earther recently. The flat earther, his complaint at the time was that he didn't like where the rockets were pointed. According to his logic, if you really wanted to launch a satellite into orbit, you'd point it straight up for the most upward thrust to fight against gravity. Not that these flat earth guys believe in gravity, mind you. Instead, he noticed that often rockets tended to veer off at angles. The gentleman thought that this was just a ploy to ditch the rocket too far away for witnesses to see. The idea of orbital injection velocities as well as other aspects of physics tended to be lost on most of these fellows. With regard to orbital velocity, if there was an unfortunate person traveling all alone, and yes, even without a spacesuit, and I know that would kill him, I keep on killing these figments of my imagination for these questions. Anyway, he's in orbit. He's in Earth orbit in free fall. Now, if something struck him that was not in free fall, that was stationary with relation to the Earth, approximately, give or take, how much of a bang would that cause in relation to, say, TNT? Would it be one stick of TNT? Would it be 10, 100, 1,000, a ton, 2 tons? Anyone want to guess approximately how much TNT a human body in orbital velocity would give up if it was stopped instantaneously?
Energy of kinetic energy of motion is quantified by 1/2 mv². 17,500 miles an hour is a low Earth orbit speed, and a human being weighs, what, 180 pounds. That's probably, what, 90 kilograms or something like that. You multiply those together, I think we're getting close to a small nuclear blast, aren't we, Roy? I haven't done the math, but my rough guess is it's a big number.
Well, it depends what you call a big number. I mean, to me, it is a big number. The answer is it's approximately about a half a ton of TNT. Now, to me, a half a ton of TNT is more than enough. Probably any guy out there building a nuclear bomb would laugh at both of us. But as far as the numbers that I plugged in, I got about a half a ton of TNT.
And if one tiny little 632 screw was in orbit and struck you, that space astronaut, amount of penetration that would do to the human being, I guarantee you're going to be unhappy.
Yes, indeed. All these things are incredibly dangerous. Space in general is a very dangerous place to be anywhere near. Some of this stuff I posted on my links at roy.ac2gs.com. There's a lovely little YouTube where they kind of take apart the entire concept of the space force and try and explain that you don't need bullets. You could just drop ball bearings, and you'll eat up everything in its path. So it's sort of fascinating. We don't really think in terms of orbital velocities and what happens if little objects don't have the same orbital velocity that we do. And, it's worse than damn bullets. Okay, my next puzzle, if anyone heard Dick and I's conversation a few days ago, it's spoiled for them. Hopefully many of you did not. The main asteroid belt is sitting out there between Mars and Jupiter. Now, if you add up all of the mass in the main asteroid belt, how do you think it would compare to another massive body in our solar system? Do you think that it's equivalent to the mass of our Earth, our Moon, more, less? Any guesses?
WB2GXM, I will guess it is the mass of the Earth or Venus. Take your pick.
Okay, so we have one for the Earth or Venus. Anyone else with any suggestions?
WS2.
Yes, Paul.
Relating it to the biggest asteroid, Ceres, they say it's 3%. Everything in the asteroid belt is only 3% of Ceres, the one that Dawn spacecraft is orbiting even to this day. That one, that big one.
Okay, but this particular question is more related to objects that most people have a better sense of their mass, like the Earth or the Moon and such.
Yeah, it must be a very small number compared to even the Earth or the Moon. I don't know, but it's got to be very small. There's hundreds of thousands of asteroids, but the total mass is probably not that much.
Okay, very good, Paul. Anyone else with any suggestions of approximately what the relative mass of all the matter in the main asteroid belt might be in relation to either the Moon or the Earth? Okay, the answer is it's approximately 4% the mass of the Moon. So not a heck of a lot of mass out there. You know, it makes for great science fiction where people are trying to get through the asteroid belt without being destroyed. But as far as the major asteroids, you probably can amble through and not be destroyed. It's really, unfortunately, for drama, not that much of a problem. And for other people, it's a good thing that it's not that much of a drama. So the answer for that is 4% of the mass of the Moon.
One way of making a guess at that, Roy, is that if there was a hell of a lot more mass there, like equivalent to the Earth, then most likely it eventually would have gathered together and made another planet. There is a missing planet, so to speak, between Earth and Mars in that asteroid. Oh, is it between Mars and Jupiter? There's a missing planet, so to speak. When you look at the progression of masses and distances, so... there wasn't enough mass there to form a planet. Therefore, we know it's small, and 4% of the Moon. Beautiful. Over to you, Roy. KGRIW.
And WS2N, one more comment.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, I can see where the science fiction shows dreamt that up, because I remember when, in the 60s, they were developing the Pioneer spacecraft, and they were the first two that were going to go out past Mars, you know, then past the asteroid belt, and even beyond that to Jupiter and Saturn. And, this is before the Voyager spacecraft did it. So the Pioneer 10 and 11 did it, and they were really not sure if those two spacecraft was going to get through the asteroid belt. They were worried about that. And now they said, no problem. They don't even think about it. The chances of hitting something is nil.
Yeah, but unfortunately, you still use that plot device with the public because they don't remember those things. So it'll still be in science fiction shows. It's, what can I tell you? Better in science fiction shows than in reality, right?
I concur.
Okay, I have one more question tonight on the puzzle section. What about the Kuiper asteroid belt? That's the one past Neptune. It's not accurately measured yet, and we have a rough idea. The belt includes the good old demoted dwarf planet Pluto, and we count the theoretical planet 9 that is yet to be proven. But the Kuiper belt's got to be made of a lot more mass, I would assume that people would assume. So, do you think that it has, say, as much mass as the Earth? Twice? Half? More or less? What do you guys think?
I believe at the time they were downgrading Pluto from a planet to a subplanet, planetesimal, whatever, they had discovered something even larger than Pluto. There's going to be a number of things out there added together are bigger than Pluto, but I think, and here I'm a little bit fuzzy, Pluto, I believe, is smaller than our Moon. So that Kuiper belt added it all together, I think we're getting close to the mass of a planet. I didn't say which planet. Very vague guess, as you can tell. Over to you, Roy. KGRIW.
Okay, Okay, but it's well thought out, and you're close to the answer. Does anyone else have any kind of idea? Let's just take Earth as the standard. So I guess the question is it something like two or three Earths? Is it a tenth of an Earth? Is it one Earth? I mean, you know, just pick your ratio, I guess.
WS twin. I'm going to go with the Earth is probably the equivalent of, you take Pluto, there's other planet, other.